Hello and welcome to the Antifada, where unrest is best. I'm Jamie Peck, and I am here on this beautiful Martin Luther King Day with Aaron Thorpe of Trillbillies at a Time of Monsters. You probably know him already. He's been on before. And Andre Demise, contributing editor of Acclaims Magazine and host of the Drop Squad for the Resistance Noir Podcast Network. How are you guys doing today?
Chilling.
Good, good.
Yeah.
Chilling on this beautiful, sacred day.
Well, sacred for you. We don't get Martin Luther King Day off in Canada, so it's one of those holidays if you're black and you say to your boss, hey, listen, I'm taking Martin Luther King Day off, you might get the day off or you might not. Who knows, depending on how racist your boss is. But, yeah. You don't get the day off.
I feel like that should just be like, I mean, even though Martin Luther King, obviously, like, you know, American. But I feel like even if you're just in North America as a black person, like, you should just, you know, enjoy, like, that day. Like, all white people should Venmo you money or Cash App you money or something like that.
Oh, my gosh. Don't get, like, the Cash App Twitter. You know, for every emotional injury you inflict by disagreeing with their opinions, you have to Cash App them $500. Don't be saying that shit, bro.
I should drop the Venmo link.
Curted energy into this podcast.
I respect the hustle.
You know, reparations.
I would not fault you for doing that, Aaron.
Petty reparations.
That is a fine thing to do.
Well, seeing as how your medical bills are, like, bro, you're gonna have to, like, work, you know, three lifetimes to cover the medical bills. So, yeah, I think we'll have to excuse it in your case.
Yeah, I haven't even fucking started handling that shit yet, man. But people have been passing around some video that apparently I can, like, you know, get my my bill lowered. So I'm gonna look into that. But yeah. It's gonna be for the rest of my life. It's fine.
Jesus Christ. Well, I don't know why you're so concerned, because our friend, the great man, Barack Obama, passed a great, great piece of healthcare legislation that made all of your medical debt problems go away, no?
Exactly. Of course. It improved access, right, to healthcare. Yeah. And we live in a system with universal single-payer healthcare now. That is what Obama did for us.
Oh, boy. So if you guys haven't figured it out by now, we are talking about our former president, Barack Obama, and his book, A Promised Land, which is very fitting for Martin Luther King Day, because as he reminds us several times in the book, he finished the work that Dr. King started.
Yes.
Jesus
Christ.
Yes, he did. Yeah. You know, and he actually, I think, sort of paved the way to make it safe for people to say, you know, we are our ancestors' wildest dreams. And for that, I'll never forgive him. You know, there's a straight line you can draw between Barack Obama's presidency and a bunch of medical students going out to a plantation where, like, you know, Negro bones are still buried and taking, like, a really glam photo and saying, we are our ancestors' wildest dreams in front of, like, the slave quarters shack. You know, that's that was something great that he gifted us. You know, those photos you see on Twitter and Instagram every so often that, you know, just make me, like, grind my teeth into dust. Yeah. Thanks, Obama.
Oh, man. I've seen people do shit like that at, like, the Holocaust Memorial.
Jesus, man. I mean, it's
people do that at Holocaust memorials for real?
I've seen people, well, they don't say that phrase, but they'll, like, take these, like, really cute selfies by, like, the Holocaust Memorial, like, hashtag sad, like, thinking about
the Holocaust. Oh, my gosh.
What the fuck? For the clout, man.
Yeah. It's also, like, I don't know, funeral selfies kind of seems in the same genre.
Although, like, some of the funeral selfies are fire. I don't know if you've seen that one where the dude, like, takes a photo, like, in front of the church, and he's like, yeah, I had to come out to my haters' funeral just to make sure the N-word dead, which was just...
Oh, that was
legendary. I actually did appreciate that one a lot. Yeah. So, yeah, in regards to Obama and healthcare, like... Oh, sorry, go ahead, Aaron.
No, I just wanted to add, like, you know, like, on MLK Day, like, everybody wants to exploit his legacy, you know, even people that would have, like, you know, despised him back in the day had they been alive. And it feels no less insulting when Obama does it, you know.
No.
It's a very schizophrenic book. Like, yeah. It's a very schizophrenic book.
I'll tell you,
yeah,
if Barack Obama had been alive, if Barack Obama had been alive when MLK was still around, like he would have totally sneak dissed him, just like he sneak disses every other black person that he comes into contact with in this book outside of his own family. But yeah, he would have been throwing pots at MLK.
Everyone, it's so great. Like he's such a bitch. Like he hates Hillary so much. He's so good. It's just like saying stuff where like he's being nice, but you know that he's actually not. Is there like a black word for that?
Sneak dissing.
Sneak dissing.
Yeah, I just said it. Sneak dissing or throwing shade or whatever. But there's like if you read the book from the lens of what does he think about black people, which is, I mean, immediately how I had to read the book, I was like, man, he really does not like black folks at all. So the idea that, he's like the completion to MLK's legacy, he probably would have told MLK, well, you know what? I liked the marches. I liked the speeches, but I think that there was something lacking in terms of policy and substance. You know, like it would have been on some like respectability bullshit, which is how he's been throughout this entire book. And the thing is, he doesn't actually talk about black people all that much because this is supposed to be like the first and was it like three volumes or something like that? I think he's going to address like race matters in probably the next volume. But for the time being, like whatever like small like snippets that you see in this book that have anything to do with black politics, black revolutionary or radical tradition or anything like that, it's all throwing shade.
Yeah. I mean, he like when he talks about Jeremiah Wright, I know we'll get into it more, but he does mention Jeremiah Wright, you know, who came out with that quote that said something like the chickens came home to roost or something like talking about 9/11. I mean, there were a bunch of like quotes that got pulled out like when Obama was running that where he pretty much had to discredit Jeremiah Wright. And it's like then when he later talks about like Larry Summers or like Tim Geithner, like these Wall Street ghouls who he brought on to like, you know, his economic, like, you know, policy, like whatever. It's like he just forgives those people very easily, even though they had a direct role in like the economic crisis that happened, right?
He
loves them and he apologizes for them consistently. But Jeremiah Wright is like, nah, this is a little bit too much. The fact that he said that this country could never get past like racism is a little bit too much for Obama, apparently.
Well, let's get into this because I got some questions on the sheet for you guys. I think they're going to be a lot of fun. So we're kind of answering the first one already. General impressions of the book. How did it make you feel? Was there anything you liked about it? Do you believe the things he says? Is he a cold-blooded sociopath or just a guy who really wants Americans to come together?
Go ahead, Andre.
I don't know where you really want me to start on that, because I think y'all might already know how I feel about Barack Obama, but I actually tried to give the book the benefit of the doubt. How it made me feel was angry. Like I did a tweet thread a little while back, and the problem is I generally will like nuke my tweets every few months just to like keep myself humble. But I was tweeting about like what I was reading from the book. I think everyone picked up on some of the excerpts from the early chapters where he was talking about, you know, himself at university, and people really picked up on like, you know, he would like I forget what the order of operations was, but I think he said like, you know, Marx for like the long-legged socialists, and like who else did he say? I think he said like Hegel for like
the ethereal bisexuals
or some shit like that. Yeah. People picked up on that because that was just really fucking weird. But, you know, I wonder how deep into the book everyone got, because I didn't see any excerpts from the later chapters. I definitely did. His takes on foreign policy are just fucking atrocious. And I think a lot of that has to do with the fact that his mother was so worldly and that he did a lot of traveling when he was young. You know, and the fact that they lived in Indonesia for a little while. And I know that, you know, people have this general impression of Americans that Americans are not worldly and that they don't travel, don't really know much about global affairs. Now, I don't know how true that is or isn't, but it definitely feels like he holds that point of view. So anytime that he's talking about foreign policy, he'll just get things so wrong. And, you know, I get that you're the former president of the United States and you've got a line to carry for American imperialism, but people aren't stupid, you know, and the the feeling that I got from reading this book is somebody who is talking to me like I'm a complete nincompoop and I've never read a book in my life. I really didn't appreciate that.
I mean, like I said earlier, the book was just incredibly schizophrenic, right? Because it was almost like reading a diary of like a serial killer, right? Like he tries to like rationalize like the sickest shit in the world. Like, I mean, can I just read that? There's just one quote where I literally had to write amazing next to it because it just fucking blew my mind, yo. So he's talking about, you know, picking Rahm Emanuel to be his chief of staff, right? And mind you, he describes Rahm Emanuel as the mastermind of the 2006 Democratic wave that had taken back the House. He also says he knew financial markets from a working stint on working on Wall Street. So it's like he acknowledges, like, right off the bat, like that, or actually, I should say, doesn't acknowledge, because how did Rahm Emanuel help take back the House in 2006, right? By running a bunch of like blue dog Democrats, conservative Democrats. Like, that's what Rahm Emanuel is known for, like, you know, being like that cudgel against the left. And this quote just like blew my fucking mind, right? He says, quote, didn't he, talking about Rahm Emanuel, didn't he represent the same old triangulating, Davos attending, Wall Street coddling, Washington focused, obsessively centrist version of the Democratic Party we had been running against? But then he says, in order to advance progressive policies like universal health care or immigration reform, it was not only possible but necessary to avoid doctrinaire thinking, to place a premium on what worked and listen respectfully to what the other side had to say, end quote. So it's like his whole like sort of cabinet of rivals thing, which is the larger indictment of liberals and their like, for some reason, like self-flagellation and obsession to be like cucked to the right. And the book is like all about that. It's all about him apologizing for why he had to drone certain countries, why he had to do this, because he didn't want to be seen as soft by Republicans. And it's just like Andre said, it was infuriating to read.
Yeah, I think I came away with a similar impression of it. Surprise, surprise. Like he kind of reminds you of Lena Dunham in a way, because, you know, there's nothing you can say about Barack Obama that he hasn't already said about himself, probably in the last 5 minutes in this book. Okay, guys, like he does it over and over again. He does it with Reverend Wright. He does it with sending more troops to Afghanistan. He does it with, you know, doing the bullshit Romney care healthcare plan instead of Medicare for all, and letting Joe Lieberman fucking nuke the public option. He's like, look, I know you think it sucks that I did this and I feel bad about it, but here's why I had to do it. Here's why I had no choice.
I got to make sure I get my Obama impression in. Andre did one. You just did one, Jamie. That was a good one. What'd you say, Dre? I didn't hear you.
Let's hear yours. I'm gonna put you on the spot. Let's hear yours.
Oh man, I'm gonna read a quote. I'm gonna read a quote then, real quick.
Oh God,
he said, he's talking about Biden. He had pronounced me articulate and bright and clean and a nice looking guy. A phrase surely meant as a compliment, but interpreted by some as suggesting that such characteristics in a black man were noteworthy. Yeah.
Oh my God. That's so good.
All you gotta do is just like break up your cadence and speak from the back of your throat. You got it.
I mean, you just have to completely abandon any sense of like blackness. That's what you
You know what's wild too? You know what's wild is that like he went from like the non-black black guy like early on in the 2008 primaries, or you know, even like in late 2007 when he announced that he was planning on running for the Democratic presidential nomination. You know, he came across as somebody who was like kind of affable, but not like black. And then it wasn't until after he won North Carolina, because a lot of people, I think, didn't believe that he was going to be able to beat Hillary Clinton. Like the Clinton machine was just too strong in North Carolina. And a lot of black people were mad at him for running against Hillary Clinton in the first place. So like, hey, brother, wait your turn. And then so people were like making claims about his blackness and calling it inauthentic. And well, they weren't calling it inauthentic. They were just this is back in like 2008. Right. So all of like the Tumblr talk hadn't quite slipped into the political lexicon yet. It was just basically like, yeah, he's not real. Like he's not a real black dude. And then after he wins North Carolina, that's all of a sudden when you see like the Malcolm X talk start slipping out. He's like, remember that speech where he was talking about Hillary Clinton? He's like, yeah, don't let her try to hoodwink you. Yeah, don't let her try to hoodwink you.
Oh god!
Right, and then everyone's like, "Oh my gosh! Wait a second, he is black. He knows about Malcolm X." I think it was kind of a breath of fresh air because a lot of people had seen, like, there was kind of like two opposite poles of politics for black politicians in North America. There was like the Harold Washington and the the Marion Barry. Like, there was black politicians that I think people saw as being a little bit like too much on the stereotypical black side. And then there was also people like, what was that dude's name from New York? Was it Harold something, light skinned dude, looked real. Anyway, it's going to come back to me at some point, like 35 minutes into the recording. I'm going to shout it out and annoy the both of you. But, there's also like the politicians that were like really like clean cut, the ones that are like, you know, super presentable, the ones that like, you know, wouldn't really harm a fly. Deval Patrick kind of figures in or factors in as one of those kind of people. Back then, wasn't he the governor of Massachusetts?
Massachusetts, yeah.
At the time? Yeah. So, yeah, people saw Deval Patrick as that kind of dude. People saw Cory Booker at the time. He was the mayor of New Jersey. They saw him as that dude. And I think so, like, Barack Obama fell somewhere, like, uncanny in the spectrum. They didn't really quite know where to place him. So, defensively, they just put him on the Deval Patrick, Cory Booker side. And I think as the primary went on, people were just, like, ascribing more and more and more blackness to him. And I actually don't think that he had a hell of a lot to do with that. I think it was actually Michelle Obama that gave him that credibility, because Michelle Obama is just like, she is just a black woman. Like, you like the way that she talks, you know, the things that she's concerned about, like everything about her is just like, okay, yeah, this is a damn sister. Like, this is somebody that, you know, that looks like somebody from the family. I think she gave him a lot of credibility that he wouldn't have had otherwise. Like, if he had gone into that primary with a white wife, wouldn't happen. Like, he would have not won that nomination. And the wild thing is that the credibility that she gave him transferred over to Joe Biden. I think that Michelle Obama, and I think it was T from Champagne Sharks podcast that talked about this, but I think if it hadn't have been for Michelle Obama, you wouldn't have a President Joe Biden.
Oh, man.
Yeah, power of transference.
That's quite a lot for a woman who did not want her husband to get into politics at all.
Yo, she was the only sympathetic person. She was the only person I felt sympathetic to. And the whole time I'm reading it, I'm like, yo, you're such a fucking asshole, dude. Like, you're literally dragging her along. And at one point she's like, yo, this is what you want. This is what I never wanted. And then he just breezes over like her decision to be like, all right, I'm on board. And it's just like a quick paragraph where he just says, oh, yeah, well, I ended up talking to her. She was with it.
No, he gaslights her with a speech. Like, it must be so frustrating to be married to fucking Obama, because whenever he wants to get his way, he just pulls out his like magical speech powers. And it's like, fine. Like, I actually wrote down this passage because I know exactly what you're talking about. Like, when he, you know, he wants to run for president, his wife is mad. Like, she already didn't like it that he ran for Senate and kind of, messed up the life of their family. But she put up with it because she loved him. And then on page 71, he's kind of wrestling with his own ambitions for a second. He's doing the Lena Dunham thing again, but, you know, in the shallowest possible way, you know, as Lena Dunham would. He's saying, why would I put her through this? Was it just vanity or perhaps something darker, a raw hunger, a blind ambition wrapped in the gauzy language of service? And I underlined that part and I said, this. Or was I still trying to prove myself worthy to a father who had abandoned me, live up to my mother's starry-eyed expectations of her only son, and resolve whatever self-doubt remained from being born a child of mixed race? It's like you have a hole to fill, Michelle had told me early in our marriage, after a stretch in which she'd watched me work myself to near exhaustion. That's why you can't slow down. So then he goes through it, and you're like, wow, is he actually wrestling with his own ambition, with his reasons why he wants to do this insane fucking thing? He goes through, he uses Martin Luther King, actually. He helped him understand that his ambition is good, actually, so long as his ambition is involved somehow making the world a better place. But he's still a little bit worried about this thing that he wants to do. Not because he'd be heading an evil empire or you know, managing an economy that runs on exploited labor and extraction of resources from the global south. No, it's just that it's making his wife mad.
And so, it's also just like, yo, you know, there's that meme or whatever where people are like, you know, instead of going to therapy, like men do this. It's like, bro, you're working out, you're working out daddy, mommy identity issues, and you're foraying into politics as some filler for this eternal void. And, you know, it's, but you're running to like become like the leader of like the strongest, most powerful, like nation, the most evil nation on earth. Like, it's really sick.
Men will literally run for president, win, and drone bomb Pakistan instead of going to therapy.
Exactly.
It's so true. Oh my God. Like, he can, like, you can kind of see the inner workings of how he rationalizes it to himself as well as everybody else in the book, right? Like, there's another part when Michelle asks him, they're now in a meeting with a bunch of people, and she asks him again, why do you need to be president?
Why does it have to be you? Exactly, yeah.
When there are so many other Democrats that you say could run and win. And then he, you know, he does another fucking speech. He gets his speech Obama on. And he says, he gives this like beautiful ode to the politics of elite representation. You know, he says that Black kids will see themselves differently. Their horizons lifted. Their possibilities expanded. And like their white friends are like starting to cry. And she's like, fine, just fucking, you're going to do it. Just fucking do it. Whatever.
But he doesn't mention anything material. Like, that's one thing I noted, right? Because, yeah, he talks about, like, the hope for Black and brown and maladjusted kids that he would inspire and, like, a new kind of politics. But there's nothing material. And then, essentially, it's like his decision to run, he writes it as, like, this everyman turned hero's journey. Or like maybe this like partial accident or like congealing of events that, but it ultimately just reveals his own like megalomania, you know?
Yeah.
It's like he says, if the quote, it's on page 78, he says, quote, if these beliefs in the America he idealized were made manifest, then my own life made sense. That's like some sociopathic shit, bro.
Yeah.
Like that's some sick ass shit, dude, you know? And again, Jamie, it's like, it made, like reading it also made me feel like if I had like when I used to work before quarantine, right? And I'd be at the bar, you know, and it'd be like 12 a.m. And I know I got to wake up at like, you know, 6 o'clock in the morning to go to my like shitty diner job. But I'm like rationalizing while I'm sitting at the bar and getting progressively drunker. Like I'm rationalizing to myself, like, it's all right, yo, I'll leave at 12:30. I'll leave at 1 o'clock. And that's what this fucking book felt like, where it's like, yo, I don't even think you believe in the shit that you're writing right now, you know?
Well, that's the mind fuck about it. Cause like sometimes I can tell that he's just being cynical. And other times, like, he really seems like he believes the stuff that he's saying. And I don't know where one begins and the other ends.
It's just a schizophrenic book, man. It really
is. Where do we want to start in unpacking this whole venture? Because I'm happy to start up anywhere. There's a couple of things that I really want to just like tear the man apart on, but what like stood out to the both of you?
Oh, well,
some of the war shit about this book.
Well, on the topic that we've been discussing, he makes a point of talking about how he really inspired the help at the White House, right? The mostly non-white, the cooks and the butlers who work domestically in the residence, which it's funny because he says, you know, oh, I couldn't help but notice like all the people who work for me are Black. And it seems like a relic of a bygone era, as if, you know, that's not still the case that most domestic workers are not white. But he makes a point of talking about how they were just really, really happy to be serving him and his family at the White House. Like he had to try really hard to get them to stop wearing tuxedos when they served him dinner every night. Like, how does that sit with you guys?
I mean, I could understand. I mean, there are moments again where it's like, I feel like there's this authenticity peeking through. And I, even though I do believe he's a sociopath, like I could understand how that would genuinely make him uncomfortable. But then like he goes on, and this is like, this is even before he like becomes president. I think this is the inaugural, I think it's an inauguration, like he's writing his inauguration speech. And he makes a point of quoting Martin Luther King, his March on Washington speech, where he says, we cannot walk alone. And he references having met older Black volunteers and Black sick or disabled senior supporters and Black workers who had, quote, had quietly done what was necessary to feed their families and send their kids to school. But it's like you abandoned these folks once you got elected with your, you know, corporate favored response to the economic crisis, which, Andre, correct me if I'm wrong, but wasn't that like the greatest loss of like Black wealth? Like at the time in the country so far, like during the economic crisis?
The evaporation of Black wealth in the economic crisis was the single largest like reduction of Black wealth that had taken place. I don't remember if it was in comparison to you know, the Great Depression or if it was just period, but I do know that in the last 100 years there had been no larger destroyer of Black wealth than the 2008 financial crisis. And what really pissed me off about that, that's when I was working in the financial industry, right? And nothing had actually happened yet in terms of help for regular people, which wasn't really forthcoming. But I do remember when I was working in the industry, you know, a lot of my colleagues were saying things like, yeah, you know, the reason that this happened in the first place is because affirmative action had forced the banks to make loans to people who didn't qualify for it. The thing is, it's one thing if it's just a regular person who's maybe watching like CNBC and getting misinformation, but these were people with like, you know, advanced degrees and shit repeating and propagating this information both inside the office and to their clients. And what they knew what the actual truth was. And what the truth was that banks were deliberately offering like high interest mortgages or mortgages that started off on a low teaser rate, but then blew up after like a year or possibly 2 years into a higher interest mortgage. So these were like subprime mortgages that were being offered to people that had regular ass credit. And they knew this information, were still propagating it. And what I didn't like about this book is that Obama didn't really push back against that at all. And I think part of the reason he doesn't is because what he does after he assumes the reign of president and introduces the stimulus package was that he gave all this money towards corporations and NGOs and didn't bail out homeowners, which was like this, I think, should have been the single largest priority. He should have also made sure that these bankers that were essentially flouting, if not completely breaking the law, would have gone to jail. Didn't want to do that either. You know, there were people that had Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac mortgages that he could have offered some amnesty on. Offered either like a mortgage freeze or possibly exemption or relief of some kind. Didn't do that. Didn't bail out the Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac mortgage holders. So they ended up getting their houses foreclosed on, just like yeeted out of their fucking zangiefed out of their houses by sheriffs for owing like a month or possibly 2 months worth of mortgage. And then people were just like driving down blocks and snapping up these houses on the cheap. So to me, like the destruction of Black wealth talking point, I don't think quite fully captures like how much, I don't know if you want to call it benign neglect or if it was malevolent neglect, like a purposeful, like, yeah, fuck y'all kind of neglect. But that's actually one of the things that infuriated me about his residency. And it's what really like disillusioned me shortly after he took office.
But he made the butlers so happy. And that kid got to come to the White House and touch his hair. Like, that's really important.
Right. He takes photo ops where kids are allowed to touch his hair. Like, everything, man, everything about that, even though it was a Black kid that was touching his hair, like, everything about that is terrible. Like, I remember that. You know, like, oh my gosh, look at this. This is my president. I'm like, has this Black child never touched a Black man's hair before? Like, why is this picture important to you?
It was very, like, voyeuristic, you know, or like exhibitionist. Yeah. You know what I mean?
And like, who was that for?
And actually, yo, Dre, all that tip too, like if we're going to talk about it, like the financial crisis, I mean, there are like lines in this book, quotes in this book that will like haunt me, like haunt me for like a couple days after at least. Like it was like the most quietly disturbing book that I've ever read.
Yeah.
There's this one point where like literally it blew my fucking mind, like almost through the book. He says when he's like talking about assembling his economic team, he says on page 211, this is insane. He says, quote, I loved the various up-and-comers who had advised me throughout the campaign and felt a kinship with left-leaning economists and activists who saw the current crisis as the result of a bloated and out-of-control financial system in dire need of reform. But that's what he should have just called this fucking book. But with the world economy in free fall, my number one task wasn't remaking the economic order. It was preventing further disaster. For this, I needed people who, by definition, might be tainted by the sins of the past. And he fucking hires Larry Summers and Tim Geithner.
Larry Summers and Tim Geithner.
Who worked for fucking Kissinger. What the fuck?
And he loves to compare himself to FDR, right? Every yes. fucking chance he gets. He's like, I want to do a new deal because I'm like FDR. But then he's like, but I couldn't do any of these transformative things because it was a financial crisis. Like, what the fuck do you think the New Deal was?
Exactly.
What do you think it was in response to, dude?
But what he ends up doing instead is that he just gives power back to the people who created the crisis in the first place. Like, that's the thing that just blows my mind about his economic response is that, like, because he's not a socialist, right? He's not a leftist, right? And it's like masquerading as pragmatism, but it's really just like sociopathic as fuck, right?
Oh! You want to talk about sociopathic as fuck? Just a couple of pages later, when he talks about he's talking about the need for shoring up America's defense, and then sort of like finding a way to put a kinder, gentler face on U.S. Foreign policy and the military, etc. So he's looking at his SecDef. So he says, it's fair to say that President Bush's Secretary of Defense and I did not hang out in the same circles. Once you got beyond our common Kansas roots, i.e. Gates had been born and raised in Wichita, it was hard to imagine two individuals who had traveled such different roads to arrive at the same location. Gates was an Eagle Scout, a former Air Force intelligence officer, a Russia specialist, and a CIA recruit. Now, this is where it gets fucking hairy. At the height of the Cold War, he served in the National Security Council under Nixon, Ford, and Carter, and in the CIA under Reagan, before becoming the agency's director under George H.W. Bush. He'd previously been nominated by Reagan, but questions about his knowledge of the Iran-Contra affair had led him to withdraw. I.e., he got caught up in the Iran-Contra affair, and he resigned before somebody tried to throw his ass in jail. Okay. But then he says, with Bill Clinton's election, Gates left Washington, D.C., joined corporate boards, and later served as president of Texas A&M University. So when Bill Clinton comes into office, he thinks to himself, oh, shit, my time might be up right now. Time for me to, like, jump on the corporate bandwagon. Yeah, exactly, yeah. Right? So he heads out the revolving door, joins the corporate world, heads up university, and then says, a post he would hold until 2006 when George W. Bush asked him to replace Donald Rumsfeld at the Pentagon and salvage an Iraq war strategy that was then thoroughly in shambles. So it's like, so out of all the people that you could have, I mean, granted, there are really no good choices when it comes to hiring a SecDef, but you want to keep on the Secretary of Defense that headed up the CIA under Reagan, that was in the National Security Council under Nixon, Ford, and Carter, and was also implicated in the Iran-Contra affair. What exactly about your presidency was so transformative? Like, what about it was a break with the past? What about it resembles an FDR in the slightest? And he never answers that in this book. He never actually talks about the change he actually brings.
Oh, he
which
does.
Was a theme throughout his entire campaign. Well, he talks about it. What I'm saying is, like, there's no demonstration of substantial change.
What I mean when I say he does is that right under where he's talking about Gates, right under that part where he's talking about Gates, he says that there was a final reason I wanted Gates on my team, and that was to push against my own biases. The starry-eyed idealists who instinctively oppose military action and believe that every problem on the international stage could be solved through high-minded dialogue had never been entirely accurate. Like, he keeps on the two most consequential issues, right? Economic policy and foreign policy or war. He just wants to pick, like, have this bipartisan, like, you know, this cabinet of pragmatic bipartisanship. And it's like, dude, these motherfuckers are going to eat you alive, because even against the implication that he has better instincts, it's like,
oh, whoa. It was worse than that. He has the nerve to refer to Dwight D. Eisenhower's warning about the military industrial complex. And what he says is that, you know, I had my feelings about the possibility of pushing reform. But then he says, there was a high likelihood that pushing reform might be harder for a newly elected African-American president who'd never served in uniform, had opposed a mission that many had devoted their lives to achieving, wanted to rein in the military budget, da 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 da. So what he's basically saying is, yeah, I wanted to do all these things, but being the black guy, I don't think it could have been me.
Yeah.
So what do you what are you teaching people? You're basically saying that in order for you as a black person to actually act as the president of the United States, you have to jump through all of the hoops that white people set for you. So really, as a black person who is the president, you have no power whatsoever. You just have to go along with like whatever the fuck people expect of you, never have an original idea of your own and act on it. So it's like this is full of these intentions. Like I wanted to do these things, but I'm sorry, my hands were tied because being a black president and my
like I was just a nigga, I couldn't do nothing about it.
My problem with it is so much
really
that he says
bad
it.
About it.
Well, it's not so much that he says it, it's that other people co-sign this shit. Because you hear people say that all the time. Why didn't he go for universal healthcare? Black president couldn't have done it. Why didn't he close Gitmo? Black president. Why didn't he bail out homeowners? Black president.
So
why didn't he jail
did
the bank? Black president. Exactly. What the fuck did you run for president for if a black president can't accomplish shit? That's what pisses me off so much about this part.
Actually, you know what? That's a good point too, right? Like, it's the whole entire book is him just living up to a white ideal, right? Like, he's just, like, you were talking about earlier, Audrey, like, there's that weird, like stratum of, like, Deval Patrick and people like Cory Booker, but Obama was sort of in this little gray area, but then you find out, like, no, he's just, like, appealing to what he thinks white people, or what he says in the book is, like, kind of the political establishment, right, and people who had been there for decades.
Harold Ford Jr. I knew it was going to happen in the middle of nowhere. Harold Ford Jr. I'm so sorry. Go ahead.
Oh, that's the guy you were talking about, Harold Ford Jr.
Yeah. Harold Ford. And they got him on this messaging. He ran for, I forget what seat it was, but he was running for Congress, and his opponent released a commercial about him, basically like, talking about how much he was a party guy, and one of the highlights in that commercial was some blonde white chick saying, "I had so much fun at the party last night. Call me Harold," and then she like makes a little one hand signal to her head, and it was like, okay, so I know exactly what y'all are trying to say. You're trying to say that, you know, he's like the black dude that's just like running through all the white women. I like, it's not hard to see that, but the thing was, he actually lost off the strength of that campaign.
I know you're talking about. This guy's on fire. He loves bipartisanship. Like, he gets into this funny little one-upmanship contest with John McCain during the campaign just to see who can be more bipartisan. And meanwhile, like, we see the rise of the Tea Party and all these right-wing psychopaths who just, like, want to fucking lynch him on the White House lawn for being a Muslim. And he's like, the favor's going to break.
Yeah. Actually, yo, why don't we get – I mean, like, James, like, is show, but why don't we get going? To that next week? Like, why don't we get into that too? Because I think that one of the most amazing things is like his sort of response to like he's talking about John McCain, and then later he talks about Sarah Palin, and like he truly does believe that like John McCain's like a maverick. Like, he truly is disappointed when John McCain, as he's running in the Republican primary, starts to like tack a little bit more to the right. And it's like the most infuriating thing like ever, especially when he talks about Sarah Palin and mentions her appeal that there were white working class people who felt as if the liberal elite, or, you know, that elite establishment would look down on them. And he says as well, too, he says something like, it's not entirely unjustified. But it's like, even then, he can't fully admit that even he himself, remember that clinging to their guns and Bibles quote that he gave?
Yeah,
even he himself fucking hates like people. He fucking hates people.
Yeah,
I don't know if it's much that he hates people. Sorry, go ahead.
The way he deals with racists in this book is very interesting, and I want to get into it because it seems like he's both way too nice to racist white people at the same time that he's incredibly condescending and he hates them. And I'm not just talking about Hillary Clinton. Like, when he talks about, It's interesting, right? Because at the very beginning, he starts with this conviction that racism is not inevitable, which I actually agree with, because I understand, you know, as a Marxist, that race and racism are fairly recent political constructions which arose from a specific set of material conditions in history, right? Not just an ahistorical fact of humanity, which is important to us as communists, because a lot of the white proletariat, a lot more of the white proletariat is going to have to get on board with black liberation if we ever want to have a revolution. But that's not where Obama is going with this, believe it or not. Because his next sentence is, a quote, The conviction that racism wasn't inevitable may also explain my willingness to defend the American idea, what the country was, and what it could become. So basically what he's saying here is we can go from white supremacist capitalism to woke capitalism, and everything will be fine, and you can make the racism go away by just kind of talking, saying the right words to these dumb white people and appealing to the better angels of their nature.
Yes, he says, I knew that in order to accomplish that, I needed to use language that spoke to all Americans and propose policies that touched everyone. And it's like, dude, I understand like this desire, of course, like as Marxist myself, right, to unite the white and black working class. But it's like when you're reading this, you're understanding that like because of, and I think we were talking about this, Andre, earlier, because it seems that he gets a lot of his like his instincts from his grandmother. Right. Mm-hmm. And he describes his grandmother as someone who's a bit more kind of patient and who is someone who kind of, how can I say, like kind of takes things slowly. Right. And even though she's had like, you know, a long and maybe difficult life, she's sort of like he admires like her patience. Right. And her sort of steadiness. But then it's like that just seems like that manifests itself in him giving preference again, like you were saying, Jamie, to racist ass white people or white people that just don't fucking like him or the Republican Party. Right. Instead of like actually choosing a side and understanding like what race and racism is, he just thinks that he can just talk people out of it. Right. And if he just says the right things to everyone, he can unify the country. And he did the exact fucking opposite. Right. He did the exact opposite.
Kind of did that on a very shallow level, right? Because he got white people to vote for him and he sort of united this multiracial working class coalition behind a broad populist program, which is what Bernie was trying to do. But he did it on the most superficial level possible and, you know, for very bad, disingenuous ends and outcomes.
God, man. It's just...
There's actually something else in that section. And it's funny how you keep on bringing up like the same sections that I highlighted. So it tells me that we're kind of on the same page. But in that same section, he talks about like, you know, his debates that he had with people as a young person about America, right? So he says, as a young man, I chafed against books that dismissed the notion of American exceptionalism. All right, so we're already off to a bad start. Got into long, drawn out arguments with friends who insisted the American hegemon was the root of oppression worldwide. I lived overseas. I knew too much. And this is exactly what, remember, okay, before we started, I said, does he not seem like somebody who's, you know, lived for a little while overseas and then talks to people like they've never read a book in their entire lives or like they have no experiences of their own? He says, I knew too much. That America fell perpetually short of its ideals, I readily conceded. The version of American history taught in schools with slavery glossed over and the slaughter of Native Americans all but omitted, that I did not defend. The blundering exercise of military power, the rapaciousness of multinationals, yeah, I got all that. It's like, bro, what the fuck? Yeah, I get all that. Then he turns around and says, but the idea of America, the promise of America, this I clung to with a stubbornness that surprised even me. We hold these truths to be self-evident that all men are created equal, yeah, blah, 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 blah. Okay, so when he says, like, he brings up, like, the Wright brothers, he brings up Gettysburg, he brings up Johnny Cash performing at Folsom State Prison. And so it's like, so music artists performing in a prison, Thomas Edison, like, either inventing or stealing shit, a couple of guys making airplanes, and the president of the United States having to maintain the union by going to war against slave states that wanted to secede. And not going to war with them because they were slave states, but because they wanted to secede, you're going to stack those anecdotes up against, I don't know, like you're going to stack that up against like the occupation of the Philippines up until the 1940s. You're going to stack that up against like the United Fruit Company. You're going to stack that up against like the occupation of Afghanistan. That's really what your argument is that this idea that has never actually been realized, like the rapaciousness against Haiti, you know, the annexation of Hawaii and Puerto Rico, all of that means nothing to you. That's a yeah, I got that. But this thing that Americans tell themselves about who they are as a people and what America means as a country, this delusion, like this grand delusion everybody else wants to put themselves through. You're saying that is the real America and everything that America actually did. Yeah, yeah, I got all that. And I was like, man, fuck you. And this is where like I completely agree with Aaron when you say that he's the guy's a fucking sociopath.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you know, it's interesting when you put on all that historical context, he really does just sweep over it. Anytime he mentions something historical, right? Like when he's talking about like in the Middle East, right? Because he goes and he travels to the Middle East while he's on the campaign trail, right? To show off some kind of show of force, right? As like a young, inexperienced, like presidential candidate, right? He wants to prove that like he has the chops to like, you know, be on the world stage, right? And he kind of like half-assedly like mentions his trip to Afghanistan, where he says something about the Soviet invasion that began in 1979, or when the Taliban took over in the mid 90s. But he never actually contextualizes like why the Taliban took over in the 90s, right? There's Soviet aggression, and then suddenly the Taliban just takes over, right? It's not about the United States and its own like influence in that region of the world, right? Everything is just completely washed over. And I'm assuming because he understands that his readership has the same ideal of America that he does, that they too will read it over and just excuse it, right?
Well, he does make a nod. Aaron and I split up the chapters, folks, by the way, so we both didn't have to read the whole thing. He does make a nod in one of the chapters to the fact that they armed the force that ended up evolving into, was it Al-Qaeda, Taliban? Yeah. One of the two in Afghanistan. But he's like, but we had to do that because of the Soviet occupation. And he hates the USSR. Like the part where he talks about the USSR is like, man, I thought this guy was smart. Like the mask slips a little bit because it just reads like straight up propaganda. Like he doesn't even bother with the to be sure paragraph so much in this part.
Doesn't he call it Marxist? That wasn't my section, but doesn't he just call it Marxist totalitarianism or something?
Yeah, yeah. And like, oh my God. No, like I underlined the whole thing. I put it up on Twitter. I'm like, oh, that's it. I'm a fucking tanky now.
Yeah, I saw that, yeah.
I don't even want to read it. I'm going to get mad again.
Yeah, no. Like that, my tanky arc actually got completed this past week. Like I don't know if you saw that Bill Gates is now like the largest owner of farmland in America.
No,
I did not know that.
It was Business Insider, I think, that posted this article basically saying that like the largest owner, like single owner of farmland in America is Bill Gates. I was like, fuck it. I'm a Maoist now. All right. The Maoism intensifies. I'm a fucking tanky. Let's go. But yeah, in that section, he was talking about, the Russian Empire and, you know, how it is that, you know, Russia went from this totalitarian state to this state under Putin. And he has this Jordan Peterson understanding of Marxism. And I'm not sure if you know what I'm talking about. Like, I don't know if you ever saw the debate between Peterson and Zizek, which I was actually at, by the way. I was at that debate. I was bombed out of my fucking mind. And I was watching it with a few of my best friends, including David Slavik and Heidi Matthews. But once we were watching that, it just dawned on me. I'm like, Jordan Peterson doesn't know fuck all about Marxism. This is wild. How does he get to have this much like airtime and this much space to talk about Marxism and talk about a concept he knows nothing about? And the same thing with Obama here, although I think he does actually know a little something about Marxism. But again, because he assumes that his readers have never read anything, he can just say things and make them true. So, for example, he says, when in the mid-1980s, Mikhail Gorbachev took over as the general secretary of the Communist Party and ushered in the cautious liberalization known as Perestroika and Glasnost, I studied what happened closely, wondering if it signaled the dawning of a new age. And when, just a few years later, the Berlin Wall fell... Now, there's no like link at all here. He just jumped from Perestroika and Glasnost to the fall of the Berlin Wall, and there's no connective tissue between the two whatsoever, right?
Well, the reader's supposed to fill in that gap, right? Based on American myth-making.
Yeah. Democratic activists inside Russia lifted Boris Yeltsin to power. Democratic activists did not lift Boris Yeltsin to power! That was 100% the United States. Sweeping aside the old communist order and dissolving the Soviet Union, I considered it not just a victory for the West, but a testimony to the power of a mobilized citizenry and a warning for despots everywhere. Except in 1993, Boris Yeltsin rolls up a bunch of tanks to Parliament because the communists didn't like him and were going to defeat his government. What the fuck is this shit? Like, you think I'm stupid?
No, he definitely does. And you're right. Like, he does understand it. He is smart, but he's talking to the reader like they're dumb because, you know, he thinks Americans are dumb. I really want to talk about the beer summit. I feel like we have to.
Oh, no.
I didn't get to that part.
So I'm going to have y'all come in.
Because, like, I'm trying to look for, he really doesn't write about Black Lives Matter at all in this book. Which is sort of striking because, I mean, maybe it'll be in the second volume.
He's saving it for the next volume.
Yeah.
All right. Well, because this is, you know, this is a movement that bloomed during his presidency and was in many ways a condemnation of a lot of the things that he claimed to be doing for Black people in this country, right? And as an abolitionist, I paid special attention whenever he talks about the cops in this book. So 397, he talks about the fucking beer summit that he had to have after what he refers to as a white working class cop who was just doing his job. Fact check, cops are not workers. Arrests a Black Harvard professor for trying to break into his own home. And to be fair, he's saying that this is how people perceived it, right? Conservative media outlets barely hit their glee, portraying my comments as a case of because he said the most mild possible thing he could have said about this, which is he said the cops acted stupidly, right? He didn't say they acted racistly. He didn't say anything bad. He just said he just has like normal Obama condescension.
And that was his friend. That was his friend. That's the most he can muster up. Yeah,
of course. And then it became a thing in the press. And his aide tells him the way it's being consumed, people think you called the police stupid. And he said, I didn't say they were stupid. I said they acted stupidly. There's a difference. Blah, blah, blah. It doesn't blow over. So he has to do the fucking beer summit, which to his credit, like he acknowledges that he knows that it was bullshit. He acknowledged that I could have calibrated my original comments more carefully. And then he had the cop and the professor to the White House with him and Joe Biden. Joe Biden, his diversity hire to get racists to vote for him. He says, for an hour or so, the four of us talked about our upbringings, our work, and ways to improve trust and communication between police officers and the African-American community. When our time was up, both Crowley and Gates expressed appreciation for the tours my staff had given their families, though I joked that next time they could probably find easier ways to score an invitation. Ha ha ha. Then he says, I underlined all of this paragraph because it's kind of insane to me that he's just, it's a weird paragraph. I want to get you guys' take on it. He says, It was my first indicator of how the issue of Black folks and the police was more polarizing than just about any other subject in American life. It seemed to tap into some of the deepest undercurrents of our nation's psyche, touching on the rawest of nerves, perhaps because it reminded all of us, Black and white alike, that the basis of our nation's social order had never been simply about consent. That it was also about centuries of state-sponsored violence by whites against Black and brown people, and that who controlled legally sanctioned violence, how it was wielded and against whom, still mattered in the recesses of our tribal minds more than we cared to admit. Right? It's just a problem in our tribal minds. It's not like he's coming right up to a materialist analysis of like the purpose that the police serve in our society and why it's not just polarizing, right?
Yeah. Like, it's not just a difference of opinion.
He's kind of both sidesing it, but then he's like, but that's in the past, and any lingering issues around this are purely the product of people's psyches, right? He's being an idealist and not a materialist.
there's a part that I want to flag, which came a few pages before that. And that's where he was talking about the, you know, what conflict led to the Beer Summit in the first place. Like, he was describing the order of events, and he was talking about Henry Louis Gates and introducing Henry Louis Gates to the reader. And because they're friends, obviously he's going to be like nice about Gates. I really do not like Henry Louis Gates. I think he's like the worst thing that ever happened to Afrocentric history, to like African history in the field. Like, he is the worst. He's one of the people. He's an awful human being. What he does is that he deliberately goes against Afrocentric consensus to try and create these new narratives. And I don't know if it's because he's somebody who works at Harvard, or if it's just because that's what he really feels, and he is that much of a sellout. But what he'll do, for example, is like feed into these narratives about Africans selling Africans into slavery, for example. So when he was trying to make a case for reparations, he wrote an article in the New York Times and then put a little side note in there saying, well, you know, yes, Africans sold Africans into slavery, which is absolute bullshit. It makes about as much sense as saying, you know, Europeans were at war with Europeans, you know, from the middle of the 15th through the 19th century. And what was really happening was that there was nations and states at war with each other. So there were nations at war with each other on the African continent, especially inside of Central and West Africa. But he doesn't distinguish, for example, between the different groups that were at war with one another. He just says Africans sold Africans into slavery, which gives people the idea that Africa has no history, that Africans are a monolith and not distinct people living within nations. So he's not going to talk about, you know, like the Fon, the Ewe, the Ashanti, the Akan, etc. You know, the various nations that you can find along the Senegambian River. I'm not going to talk about the Kingdom of Benin. Not going to talk about the Malians. None of that. What he says is Africans selling Africans into slavery. It tells people that we have no past, we have no future. But that is,
we're barbaric.
Yeah, pretty much. That, you know, they sold out other Africans for a quick buck to the Europeans because they're so backwards and savage, and not because there was nations at war with one another and that they were selling their enemies into slavery, as has always been done throughout most of recorded history. Europeans only stopped selling other Europeans into slavery because the church made them stop selling Christians into slavery, but they would still kidnap, for example, Muslim people and enslave them. That all being besides the point. He says, earlier that week, Gates had returned to his home in Cambridge after a trip to China and found his front door jammed shut. A neighbor, having witnessed Gates trying to force the door open, called the police to report a possible break-in. When the responding officer, Sergeant James Crowley, arrived, he asked Gates for identification. Gates refused at first and, according to Crowley, called him racist. Eventually, Gates produced his identification, but allegedly continued to berate the departing officer from his porch. When a warning failed to quiet Gates down, Crowley and two other officers that he'd called for backup handcuffed him, took him to the police station, and booked him for disorderly conduct. The charges were quickly dropped. So if you, standing on the front porch of your own house, who was trying to explain to an officer, this is my house, I live here, here's my driver's license, whatever it is that you need, yada, yada, yada. Well, here it is. I shouldn't have to produce any of this. And by the way, fuck you. Fuck your racist ass, which he is entirely within his rights to do because he's standing on his own property responding to a cop that had no reason to be there in the first place. Brock is putting this as if like he's done something wrong, right? He says, my own guess as to what had happened was more particular, more human than the simple black and white morality tale being portrayed. Having lived in Cambridge, I knew that his police department didn't have a reputation for harboring a whole bunch of Bull Connor types. It doesn't matter whether or fucked or not, like whether they have racist cops that you know about. If they don't have a reputation for having racist cops, it doesn't mean that they don't have racist cops, dipshit. Meanwhile, like, skip.
So well, the meanwhile, nice to me.
Yeah, exactly. But the meanwhile,
yeah, it's pretty good.
Negro, this is your friend. This is your friend that you're about to throw under the bus again. Meanwhile, as Gates was known to his friends, was brilliant and loud. One part W.E.B. Du Bois, one part Mars Blackman.
Fucking God.
What is that supposed to mean? And cocky enough that I could easily picture him cussing out a cop to the point where even a relatively restrained officer might feel his testosterone kick in.
Why does this sound like a white guy describing a black guy?
It sounds exactly like it. It sounds like his white mother kicked in at that exact moment. Like, I feel like there's like two Baracks trying to write this book. And for the majority of it, it's his white mother's Barack. that is writing any kind of story whatsoever that has anything to do with black people. Because he can't ever bring up black people without chiding them for doing something that's like not respectable in his eyes, even though the following three paragraphs were talking about the dangers of respectability politics. Like, what the... Anyway, that part pissed me off so much that that's where I just like, I was like, there's just nothing redeemable about this dude because he's so dirty. Like, even his friends, even the people that he holds close to him and even the people that he says he respects, he'll still like kind of throw them under the bus to make the reader. And again, I keep asking, like, who is this book for? But I feel like it's definitely for like white center right types as a bomb or like a healing narrative. Like, it's there for like the Biden administration to use as a way to soothe relationships between themselves and what they call the moderate right. It's not for like progressives, as they call themselves. It's not for like the left-leaning types. It's entirely for trying to repair the damaged relationships between himself and the center right. And that's like, it's more important for him to do that than to stand up for his friend. And that's even though I don't like Henry Louis Gates, that really bothers me about Barack Obama.
Well, he does the same thing. I know I mentioned it earlier, but he does the same thing with Jeremiah Wright, where Wright says something there were times when he found Wright's sermons a little over the top.
Over the top, yeah.
And apparently one of those sermons, right, that was that apparently was revealed in the Rolling Stones right before Wright is set to appear at Obama's candidacy announcement, like doing a little, like, I guess a prayer. And he says, Wright said, "We believe in white supremacy and black inferiority and believe it more than we believe in God." To which Obama replies, "Seriously?"
Yeah.
You know, and it's just like, it's just like, dude, like, and then he does this thing.
You gotta put this in there. Okay. So when he talks about Wright's sermons, he also mentions who's in the congregation. It's like, okay. I at least thought that on the matter of his church, he would leave that off limits. Like, he wouldn't throw his whole fucking church under the bus. And then he does it. This dude says, Reverend Wright, please don't be saying these things in front of these good white people because they good white people. He says about the sermons. Because, okay, let me give it the full context. He says, in the middle of a scholarly explication of the book of Matthew or Luke, he might insert a scathing critique of America's drug war, American militarism, capitalist greed, or the intractability of American racism, rants that were usually grounded in fact but bereft of context. What kind of fucking context do you think you can add to all of that? Often they sounded dated, as if you were channeling a college teaching from 1968 rather than leading a prosperous congregation that included, and this is the part that threw me, police commanders, celebrities, wealthy business people, and the Chicago school superintendent. And every so often, what he said was just wrong, edging close to the conspiracy theories one heard on late night public access stations or the barbershop down the street. And okay, this part, I actually had to put down the book, get up, walk away, and calm down before I came back to it. I literally went and put a leash on my dog, and I tucked my dog around the block before I came back to this one, okay? It was as if this erudite, middle-aged, light-skinned black man was straining for street cred, trying to quote-unquote, like scare quotes, full scare quotes, keep it real. Or maybe he just recognized, both within his congregation and within himself, the periodic need to let loose, to release pent-up anger from a lifetime of struggles in the face of chronic racism. Reason and logic be damned. Now, when you think of a political figure, think of a political figure, erudite, middle-aged, light-skinned black man straining for street cred, trying to keep it real. Who do you think of immediately? He's projecting all of his insecurities on Reverend Wright. Every last one of them.
Yes, because he wish he could be Reverend Wright. He wish he could be as, like, I mean, I don't know if he really wishes he could, because I don't think he believes in these things. But, like, Wright is talking about, like, white supremacy and, like, you know, imperialism. And you literally just, like, phrase it as flippantly, like, the periodic need to let loose. Like, what the fuck?
What does
like,
that mean?
This is what I'm talking about. Yes. Like telling, yes, telling what does
the
that truth, mean?
Telling the, exactly. He's calling him the angry black guy. You know what I mean? Like, there's no reason for him to feel this way. It's just a bunch of pent-up rage. And was like, all right, thanks a lot, Wolfgang and Farrakuti. Let's talk about subculture of violence theory and how you apply subculture of violence theory to Jeremiah Wright. Why don't we just do that? Why don't we just do some like you know unpacking some Anthony Lanmel Jr. unpacking on your fucking self, because everything that he does, like this projection that he does on the black community, I think it's like it's a photo negative aspect of himself. It's almost like if you're looking at a picture of Barack Obama the president, and then there's like the scary Fox News thing where they, or actually no, it's more like a current affairs thing where they do a photo negative, and it's like, oh my gosh, there's an evil side to this person, and the dark photo negative evil side to Barack Obama is that I feel like he's so racially insecure in himself that he cannot help that anytime he talks about a black person, he has to bring up the negative aspect of them or a part that he doesn't necessarily understand himself. And he's just going to chalk it up to black pathology. And that just, it's like, it's there throughout this book. And it's actually one of the reasons why, like the part one here, the volume one was bad enough. I kind of feel like I'm going to have to book about 6 or 7 therapist visits. Like I'm going to have to block off a solid month and a half with my therapist to get through all of the bullshit that's going to be like poisoning my brain after reading the second volume.
Well, yo, you know, you just made me think about like, you know why I think he really like enjoyed his anger translator, which was like, you know, what was it? Was it Michael Key?
Michael Key.
Key and Peele.
Yeah. I think he liked that because he like that was, I guess, a part of himself that like he would like to believe had been true, like an angry sort of black guy, you know, like to confirm to other people, like all like his black detractors who would like, you know, basically call him like, you know, you're caping for the white man type of shit. It's like, oh, no, see, I like this fictional like version of myself that's like expressing my anger. But no, he doesn't really have those beliefs or wish he could have an anger translator or be as angry as that. It's just all like a performance to prove to other black people, even while he's being condescending to them, to prove to them like I'm still one of you. Like he's so conflicted. He is so conflicted.
Yeah. He makes me want to side with the Afro-pessimists, honestly, if those are the two choices.
Oh my goodness.
Like what world are you living in?
I'm not gonna expand any further because if I start talking about the Afro pessimists on your show, that this is what's gonna the show is gonna end up being about. So I'm gonna shut up.
Oh, everyone's gonna hate us and never gonna listen to it. You're gonna have people in your DMs.
All right. Well, maybe that's a topic for another day. What was I gonna say? Oh yeah. So you talked about who this book is for, Andre, and I think that is a really important question to consider because he addresses the book. He says that it's for young people who are skeptical of America and of capitalism, right? He pretends like he's addressing it to them, but like, I feel like he kind of knows that ship has sailed and his powers don't work on us anymore. I mean, speaking only for myself, like I got tricked. I was young. I was foolish. I was, you know, a young white liberal at the time that Obama was running for president. I'm like, oh yeah, this guy seems great. He was against the Iraq war and Hillary seems like a bitch. So like, I'm going to make some phone calls for him. And then, you know, I got radicalized around the time of Occupy. And by 2012, I was voting for Jill Stein, which is, you know, not something I'm necessarily proud of, but the point is I wasn't voting for him anymore, right? But like, who is the book actually for? I don't know. Like, I think you're right. Like, he's making a show of sort of castigating the left, disciplining the left, disciplining young people, black radicals, everybody really, and saying like, look, guys, this is my legacy. I can still get these people in. I can get these people in line just like I did before. Like I can tamp down on this shit so it doesn't pose a threat to the ruling order. And it's especially dark and cynical, right? Because he can do whatever he wants now. Like he's not running for anything. he's on an island with Richard Branson, like windsurfing.
Yeah,
windsurfing. Yeah, Netflix shows or whatever. Yeah. Like, he can say whatever he wants. And this is still what he's choosing to do. And this is still who he's choosing to carry water for. And it just seems very, very dark and diseased.
He's a true believer.
Yeah, no, he's
and like, you know, yeah. He's a true believer. Go ahead, Jerry.
No, I was going to say that, you know, he had what could have been the responsibility of an elder statesman, you know, or, you know, a retired elder statesman. And, you know, throughout the Donald Trump presidency, he would just like have like little quips and anecdotes here and there. But for the most part, what he was doing, especially throughout the primaries, was chiding the left, which has always been his like predisposition. And in the book, you can really get how he believes that it's his responsibility to check his own impulses and go with what either consensus or the job demands rather than what his own beliefs are. But then he probably released this book at the very wrong time, because you never actually see him act on what he says are his initial impulses. And especially as somebody who's no longer president and should just be able to say whatever he wants, that's not what he does. If you want to think about somebody who just says whatever the fuck he wants, think of Colin Powell. Remember how like Colin Powell, he had some interviews a while back. This is, I think, around like 2000, maybe like 14, 15. And, you know, he was being asked about like Hillary Clinton, and, you know, he got exposed for, I don't know if it was like an interview or some recordings or whatever, but he reminded me of just like this old crufty Jamaican man, like reaching down and scratching his foot back and then like telling you all the gossip, you know what I mean? Like knocking back like a little bit of Jay Ray and nephew, and, you know, ready, he puts down the dominoes and said, well, let me tell you about so-and-so. You know what I mean? Colin Powell has just been saying whatever the fuck he wants ever since his retirement, to the point where people are like disowning him practically. but Barack, like, even though there's nothing for him to gain or lose at this point, right? Like, he's just become like a lifestyle influencer. But everything that he does say when it comes to the realm of politics is saying either the same as what he was saying during his presidency or even farther to the right of where he was initially. So that tells me, regardless of whether he thinks he believes these things or not, he doesn't actually really believe them. It's almost like Kwame Ture says, like, a lot of people believe that they're thinking, but all they're doing is thinking about thinking. They're not actually thinking. You know, he's talking about like the need to participate in revolutionary struggle, the need to like know about the struggle, the need to read theory, but also to participate in action. Like, if you're not, you know, participating in the struggle for your people, then you're not actually thinking. You just think you're thinking. You're reacting to stimuli. And that's what I would say the same for Barack Obama, is that he thinks that he's actually participating in some kind of political project, but he's just sitting around and wanking himself off. And the times that he actually does get up and take any action, it's in the exact opposite of what needs to be done in that moment, especially for left politics.
Exactly. Or against, like, again, an implication of, like, better instincts, right? Like, his better angels. And, like, you know, there's early on in the beginning, there's just, like, one last thing I found was really interesting. I mean, he just does this throughout the book. Somebody tells him, I forget who it is, it's, like, a senior senator or, like, a colleague or something like that. Actually, no, this is even before he gets in the Senate. This is like when he's running like for, I guess, like, is it assemblyman in Chicago or some shit like that? And he says that someone tells him that the key to surviving this place, which is like politics, right, is understanding that it's a business. And Obama, like, there are statements that are made to him like this throughout the book by people that are like more seasoned than he is, because he's young and inexperienced and idealistic is what he calls himself. And it seems that just by his kind of framing, right, and his intonation, that he like reflexively rejects these statements. But I think like he actually like has absorbed them and believes them to be true. And again, it's all this sort of like performative front where he is engaging with the audience to make, like, again, writing maybe for, like, I don't know, like the same people that like help him win, like, you know, independents, like, you know, maybe some Republicans. Like, I really don't know. Like, to answer your question earlier, Jamie, I really don't know who this book is for. He says it's for young people, but then he spent his post-presidency like maligning them. So it's like, who is it for?
Which young people are you talking about? Yeah.
Exactly. Well, it's an apology tour, which is like liberalism 101. The book is just an apology tour, but it's not to the people that you should be fucking apologizing to, you know?
Yeah. Word. Oh my God. I wrote down so many places where he thinks he can make a magic speech. And again, like, does he think that he's doing that to us right now? Or is he more cynical about it? I don't know. Like, I also read Hillary Clinton's book, and this one was much more interesting because he really seems kind of like a genuinely tortured and conflicted guy, whereas Hillary is just Hillary all the way down. You know, like they talk about it on Chapo too, how he's worse than her because she really seems like she believes all her own bullshit. Whereas, like it's not bullshit to her. That's just the way things are. Whereas he kind of knows, like he's familiar with leftist thought. He's familiar with Black radical thought. And he knows in the back of his mind that they're right, but he rejects it for reasons of his own ego and his own ambition, and then rationalizes it using MLK. I like the part where he thinks he can scold the birtherism out of people. It kind of reminds me of that song by Art Brut, We Formed a Band, where he's like, I want to be the band that writes the song that makes Israel and Palestine get along. Right, like he literally thinks he can do that with his speech to the Muslim world, and he says he's like, I know it's not going to fix all the problems, but you get the idea that he kind of thinks it's a big deal, right? Or like at 685 when he's trying to just stop people from doing the birtherism on him, and that's where Donald Trump makes his first appearance, I think. He's like, look, we got a lot of problems facing our country. We got to shape a better future together, but we're not going to be able to do it if we just make stuff up and pretend that facts are not facts. We're not going to be able to solve our problems if we get distracted by sideshows and carnival barkers. We're better than this. And just the whole time, it's like, how much power do you think you have as an individual? At the same time that you're doing things, the actions that you are engaging in, the system that you support and uphold is the very thing that produces this kind of far right reaction. I don't know. It's complicated.
Well, like, again, like, I think I mentioned this at the beginning, is like he starts out like with this like vision to unite the country. But what he ends up doing, like, unlike Sanders, right, who, like, wanted to unite, like, the correct segment of, like, the working class, right? Like, he had a specific constituency that he was going out for, like, people who, for so long, like, have not only been exploited, but had, like, either no faith in politics or just haven't felt their voices represented in politics. But Obama not only tries to, like, kind of cross these racial lines, he tries to cross these class lines, where it's like, well, these are the people that have always have had power and influence. So the minute that you let these people get the say, any like sort of instincts that you might have, right, to ignore what they want you to do, like you immediately give into it, right? Because you think you're uniting the country. And then 8 years later, he even alludes to it in a little bit when he's talking about Palin in the book, that this is what's coming, sort of. But it's like you did nothing to actually stop that. Because you didn't believe anything.
He excuses John McCain for picking Sarah Palin. He's like, John McCain is a good man. And I think if he knew what was going to happen as a result, he might have thought twice about it. Like, John McCain knew exactly what the fuck he was doing when he picked Sarah Palin. And like, it's, spoiler alert, not all that different from the normal Republican Party. It's just like Republicans on steroids. I wanted to spotlight, too, where he talks about, he's actually speaking at a Holocaust memorial in Berlin. It's very somber. He talks about the Holocaust. He blames bigotry, of course. And then he says, our history has always been the sum total of the choices made and the actions taken by each individual man and woman. It has always been up to us. But if that's true, then all the shit that he's been saying about how it wasn't up to him, he had no choice to do the things that he did, that's not true.
A lie.
Like, it was up to him. If it was up to him all along, like, you can't have it both ways, man.
Well, it doesn't apply to him because he's the strongest man, like, in the world, right? Like, somehow, as the strongest man in the world, none of this, like responsibility or anything like that applies to him. Because, like, you know, he was fraught with the task of, like, uniting this divided country. And, like, you know, like, just like, you know, maybe white people or even black people wouldn't have trusted, like, an inexperienced black president. Like, he continues to make all these excuses despite having been president of the United States. And that's, again, where I'm just like, come down. I'm like, this is the most schizophrenic, like quietly disturbing book that I've ever read. Like, it really was like reading a diary of like a serial killer.
Yeah, because like he's familiar with all of these ideas, and he knows all the shit that people have said about why America is evil, and he kind of knows that it's right. But he's like he likes the movie Parasite, right? Like, he can appreciate these thoughts as just a little bit of flavor, a little bit of color for his speeches that he can like kind of pick and choose from in this weird kind of postmodern pastiche where all of these different strains of thought are just like flattened out into a uniform cultural product that you can kind of put up on your wall as a poster and be like, oh, isn't that neat? Mm. But he's such a creep. I kind of want to end on this weird bit where he goes to Egypt. You guys, well, Aaron wouldn't have read it because it's in an odd chapter. But like, after this is kind of crazy. So after his speech to the Muslim world, where he's like, you know, America is good, actually, he goes and visits the pyramids, and he finds an ancient hieroglyphic that kind of looks like him. And then he gets really emo and philosophical. There's just this really weird part where he's sort of staring at this hieroglyphic that he thinks looks like him, and sort of he's getting really philosophical about the world and about history. He says, "I stood at the wall for an extra beat, trying to imagine the life behind that etching. Had he been a member of the royal court, a slave, a foreman? Maybe just a bored vandal, camped out at night centuries after the wall had been built, inspired by the stars and his own loneliness to sketch his own likeness. I tried to imagine the worries and strivings that might have consumed him and the nature of the world he'd occupied, likely full of its own struggles and palace intrigues, conquests and catastrophes, events that probably at the time felt no less pressing than those I'd face as soon as I got back to Washington. All of it was forgotten now. None of it mattered. The pharaoh, the slave, and the vandal all long turned to dust. Just as every speech I'd delivered, every law I passed and decision I made would soon be forgotten. Just as I and all those I loved would someday turn to dust." Counterpoint, you're writing a 3-volume book about yourself.
Yo, he literally just, it's just so diseased. What the fuck is wrong with you, man? It's like he loves to think of himself as this conflicted everyman. You know, again, like, you know, who embarks on this hero's journey. But.
I got to throw one thing in there, because this part actually like fucking floored me. I was like, bro, you accidentally wrote Percy Shelley's Ozymandias.
Like, that's what I put in there. I'm like, Ozymandias moment.
Yeah.
Maybe he's doing a literary allusion. Maybe he thinks some of us are smart enough to pick that up. I don't know.
Oh wait, hang on. No, sorry, that wouldn't be Percy Shelley. That would actually be Horace Smith's version. I'm gonna go look it up so I can actually read the fucking things. But I remember there was one part where he says, "The only shadow that the desert knows." I'm gonna have to go back and like read it and pick it up again. But yeah, like when he wrote that section, I'm getting this image of just like, you know, like sand being blown by the desert wind off of this tablet. You know, that reveals the inscribed writings, like the chiseled writings of Alexander the Great. And I'm like, is that who you see yourself as? Like, your accomplishments are going to be turned into dust, but this book shall remain. Like, this testament to humanity shall remain. Who the fuck do you think you are?
He thinks he's a lot of people. It's a perfect metaphor, yeah. Right? Because the tombs of the pharaohs, you know, they thought that they could have eternal life. And he's like, oh, but that's silly. I couldn't possibly unless ..
Yeah. Okay, I did look. Okay, I'm looking it up, and it is actually Percy Shelley's version. I'm not going to read the entire thing, but it says, "On the pedestal these words appear. My name is Ozymandias, King of Kings. Look on my works, ye mighty, and despair. Nothing beside remains. Round the decay of that colossal wreck, boundless and bare, the lone and level sands stretch far away."
That is so diseased.
Yeah. So
Jesus,
Can't wait. Can't wait until Michelle runs.
No.
What if it's like, because we're in full postmodernism, right? Maybe it's not a reference to the poem. Maybe it's a reference to a reference. Maybe he thinks he's like Walter White in Breaking Bad.
Nothing means anything.
Well, like, he's just a guy that, like, you know, like, unfortunately just had to do some bad things because of the situation, the circumstances he found himself in, instead of, like, you know, resolving on some kind of integrity or, like, you know what I mean, like, believing anything at all. It's just like, well, I couldn't do this because reasons, and we're supposed to despair over that, you know. Jesus fucking Christ.
If Michelle runs, he will have successfully transferred his corruption and deformity to someone who used to be human. And that's going to be the darkest chapter of all.
Here's the thing. I don't believe him when he says that Michelle didn't want him to run and all that. I don't. I think it makes for a very, like, relatable story. But I think she actually was down with it. Like, if she wasn't, you know, publicly talking about supporting him at those times, like for the Senate run, et cetera. I think that I don't know if I would ever see Michelle running for president. Like, I'm just kind of joking about that. I think power enjoys power without accountability. And, like, Michelle Obama has never really had to be accountable to anyone, but she is, like, feted and celebrated by a lot of people who believe that she's, like, she's Barack's conscience. But I'm like, but if she's true, if she's with him through all of that and answers no questions about U.S. foreign policy, answers no questions about the U.S. like brutality against Black lives, answers no questions about, like, the class warfare that's taking place, nothing about healthcare, none of that. But people listen to her political opinions because she's just widely beloved. I think that's the best possible position you can be in, because you're just basically the power behind the scenes. It's almost like you're a member of the Canadian Senate. You know, the Canadian Senate is completely unaccountable to the public. Like, they're handpicked by the prime minister, and they don't answer to anybody. They're not elected. So they can just basically say and do whatever they want. They're accountable only to themselves. And I kind of feel like there's a power behind the power when it comes to the U.S. presidency. And, you know, one of those is corporations, and two are ex-presidents, and three are first spouses. You know what I mean?
What if he's setting it up so that when she runs, everyone thinks she's a good person?
Yeah. Yeah, yeah,
and then she was like the moral anchor. Not that people don't already, but yeah. But, like, if she was his moral anchor, then she sucks at that job, because look at all the shit that he did.
Well, the thing is, nobody cares about that. That's the problem. Like, as people who are on the, well, I guess we can call ourselves, like, communists. Like, we're all sort of on the same page where it comes to left politics. But, you know, nobody really cares about that. When you talk to anybody about, like, drone strikes in Pakistan and Sudan, it's, you know, he did what he had to. You know, he's the first Black president, blah, blah, blah. When it comes to healthcare, he did what he had to. First Black president. When it comes to banking and financial rules, same shit. They don't actually care. So I kind of feel like people do see her as the moral anchor, because they see him as a moral president who just had to make some very tough decisions. I don't know. It's unfortunate, but the vast majority of people in America do not think like we do. And that means there's, like, a long-term political project there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's just like, this book is just, like, really, like, just like just liberalism 101. Like, every page that I've read, it was just like, it just reeks of, like, why I hate liberalism. Right. Why I hate the apology tour, the excuses for why you couldn't do this, the complete, like, abandonment of power, right? Or the desire to, like, build, like, winning and lasting coalitions, right? It's all just symbolic. Like, again, when he's talking about when Michelle asked him, and it's a pointed question, you know, like, why do you run? Why does it have to be you? And he has nothing materially to offer at all, because he doesn't believe in anything. And that's the most depressing thing. Like, I, you know, I would much rather read, like, you know, a pulp fiction, like, you know, like, science fiction novel from, like, the 50s that's fantastical and just, like, complete bullshit than read this fucking book, yo. Like, this is the greatest work of fantasy that I've, like, ever read, I think, man. It's
so dark.
It's, like, so bleak.
I I remember you just reminded me, there's a part where he talks about the financial crisis as if it's a natural disaster. And like nothing you could do. It's an act of God. This is just the way of, this is the way things are. There's no alternative. There's no way to resolve these contradictions. But that's only true if you can't look outside of capitalism, right? It's just naturalizing an unjust, like there are multiple levels, right? Because there's actually stuff he could have done within capitalism, as we know, as we've gone over. But, you know, yeah, if you want to stop having financial crises, we have to exit out of capitalism. There's just no way around that. But he doesn't want to. So I'm sorry that I made you guys read this book with me.
No, you're not. No, you're not. Don't lie to my face.
Enjoy the cruelty of life.
I feel like I owe you a lot of favors now.
You got to come on the pod. That's it. Yeah, both of y'all got to come on the pod. That's it. That's it.
Yeah.
That's how us podcasters do it. Just come on the pod. That's it.
That's fine. One hand washes the other. But thank you so much for doing it and, you know, sitting in the darkness with me. Any final thoughts? You guys excited for some hope and change in 2021?
Yo, fuck Obama.
There's nothing that I can say in response to that that's going to be fit for you to put on your podcast, so I'm just going to skip. Fuck about no politics and rap, my nigga. My little homie's done a deuce, ain't never coming back, my nigga. So you better go hard every time you jump on wax, my nigga. Fuck what they talk about, your shit is where it's at, my nigga. Came in this game, you stuck your fangs in this game. You want no chain in this game, your hood, your name in this game. Now you double up, time to bubble up the bread and huddle up. Stick it to the scripts, now if them Benjamins go cuddle up. Skip, hop, trip, drop, flip, flop with the white tube sock. It goes. That's what the product smell like when the chemicals mix. 50 niggas salute out the Compton Zoo with the extras. Elcos, Monte Carlos, Road Kings and Dressers. Rip Riders, P-Funkers, Mexicans, they fuck with you. Asians, they fuck with you. Nobody can't fuck with you. I've been A1 since day one, you niggas boo-boo. Your own boy, your block that you're from, boo-boo. Little hoes you went to school with, boo-boo. Baby mama and your new bitch, boo-boo. We was in the hood, 14 with the deuce-deuce. 14 years later, going hard like we used to on the dead homies. On the dead homies. Hopped out the caddy, just got my dick sucked. The little homies called and said the enemies just clicked up. Oh yeah, put the one on Scrabble with me, Vario. Oh yeah, tell them they can run it for the cardio. Oh yeah, everything is scandalous. Slow motion for the ambulance, the project filled with cameras. The LAPD gambling, scrambling, football numbers slandering. Niggas names on paper, you snitched all summer. Streets don't fail me now. They tell me it's a new gang in town. From Compton to Congress, set tripping all around. Ain't nothing new but a fluid new Democrats and Republicans. Red state versus a blue state, which one you governing? They give us guns and drugs, call us thugs, making they promise to fuck with you. No condom, they fuck with you. Obama say what it do. Obama say what it do. Obama say what it do. I've been A1 since day one, you niggas boo-boo. Your own boy, your block that you're from, boo-boo. Little hoes you went to school with, boo-boo. Baby mama and your new bitch, boo-boo. We was in the hood, 14 with the deuce-deuce.